Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, where this week I have the pleasure of being joined by Stanley Lewis. Stanley is the founder and CEO at A28 Therapeutics. Stanley, welcome to the show. I believe you're joining me from over on the West Coast today. Give us a quick introduction as to who you are and what A28 Therapeutics is all about.
Great. Well, thank you, James. I appreciate the opportunity to come on to your podcast. Yes, I am joining you from sunny San Diego, although
Nice.
it's not quite so sunny right now. The rare overcast day we're having out here. Yes, and I'm pleased to tell you about A28 Therapeutics. We are a late stage clinical oncology company developing a targeted lytic peptide platform for treating cancer.
Wow. Okay, a bit of a mouthful that, isn't it? All
It
so
is a
big.
bit of a mouthful, I will have to admit. And there may be some words in there that folks may not understand, but I'm happy to elaborate.
Sure. Look, I guess for my benefit and for the audience, if you could kind of run through that again word by word and kind of explain what that peptide, what that means in layman's terms, as it may be.
Outstanding. Well, one of the really cool things about oncology these days is that we're moving away from sort of these general chemotherapy types of agents that were, very effective at killing tumor cells, but also they had lots of side effects. They killed lots of healthy cells as well. So the idea now is to create therapies that are more targeted, that are more focused on just killing cancer cells. And
Right.
that is accomplished in several different ways. In our case, I think we have a very unique way of accomplishing that by finding receptors, molecules on the surface of cancer cells that are unique to those cancer cells, creating a agent that binds to those molecules on the cancer cells. And then that agent carries with it a payload or a toxic moiety that can then either enter into the cancer cells or kill the cancer cell from the outside without harming the surrounding tissue. So our molecule happens to be a targeted lytic peptide. That is, the targeting unit is a hormone, a 10 amino acid LHRH hormone, LHRH standing for luteinizing hormone releasing hormone. Don't try to say that 10 times fast. It was formerly known as GnRH, or gonadotropin releasing hormone. But that's all beside the fact. The fact is that cancer cells have an overabundance of this particular hormone receptor, so we can target those cancer cells uniquely from other cells within the body.
Wow.
The other piece of our molecule is an 18 amino acid lytic peptide. This is a short peptide. You have lytic peptides in your body naturally. You can find them in tears. You can find them associated with natural killer cells. They tend to kill anything that is negatively charged. So bacteria, for instance, have a negatively charged cell wall. And so these cationic or positively charged lytic peptides are very useful in the human immune system. Well, we've taken a lytic peptide. It's a synthetic lytic peptide, very positively charged, added it to this hormone unit that binds to that receptor. And because cancer cells are also negatively charged, like bacteria, this combined molecule is perfect for killing cancer cells. It binds to them with the hormone, and then the lytic peptide, with its positive charge, is attracted to the cancer cell with its negative charge and causes a lysis of that cell. And that's how the drug works.
Wow. So kind of all of the good bits with none of the bad bits in a nutshell.
That's a very good way of putting it. And this idea of targeted therapy has gone through some evolutions. The currently approved drugs that sort of exploit this construct usually use an antibody to bind to the cell. And they use another chemotherapeutic agent, one of the old-timey sort of chemotherapeutic agents, as the payload that actually kills the cancer cell. we are sort of next generation because we don't use an antibody. We use a much less expensive and probably a lot easier to manufacture hormone to bind to the cancer cells. And we use a lytic peptide, which is very specific for negatively charged cancer cells. It doesn't, it's not one of these other old fashioned chemotherapies that just sort of kills indiscriminately, but it's very, very specific for killing only that which is negatively charged.
Wow, that sounds absolutely incredible. The fact that it kind of what you want in all walks of life, whether it's, you know, healthcare or anything, you want something direct to solve the problem that you're trying to solve without any impacts elsewhere, right? I think that's that is the winning formula in anything, I think.
Specificity matters, absolutely. And when it comes to cancer care, that's certainly what we've been trying to move the field toward being much more specific. When you think about cancer care and you think about chemotherapy, a lot of times you'll hear patients say, you know, I don't know which is worse, you know, having this disease or having to take these medications that are supposed to give me more life. Instead, they just, I feel like I'm getting, you know, just tortured with these toxicities. So one of the reasons why I went into drug development, because as a physician, I hated the idea of having to give patients medications that cause side effects. So our motto, our vision at A28 Therapeutics is to create a world where you don't fear cancer and you don't fear its treatment.
Wow. Well, you touched on it there, Stanley, very briefly, that, you know, this was one of the reasons you got into this space. And I ask literally everyone who comes onto the show, kind of, how did you get into clinical research? So, I mean, if you were to go way back, without dating yourself too much, how did you get into this space initially? Because I know for many, many people, and certainly I'd say probably 90% of the guests that I've had on the show, they've tripped and fell into clinical research somehow. Talk us through your journey.
Yes. Okay. So let's just start at college. I went to the University of Texas in Austin. And then I graduated from there with a degree in biology, went to the University of Texas Medical School at Houston, where I did my internship, residency, and fellowship, and then joined the faculty for about 6 or 7 years. I did what faculty members do. I saw patients. I taught residents and students, and I did some clinical research. The clinical research was the part that intrigued me the most. I was taking care of mostly HIV-positive patients back at in those days. Yep. And like with cancer patients now, back then, the medicines that we were able to give patients were very, very toxic. And that made me feel terrible because I felt like I was actually violating the Hippocratic Oath, the sort of first do no harm. Yet I was putting patients in this terrible dilemma of having to decide whether you wanted to take these medications and live longer despite all the side effects, or not take these medications and die of AIDS. It was a terrible dilemma, and I really hated that. I had an opportunity to work with one drug that was the first one I ever administered to patients that had no side effects, but it was still very effective at controlling their HIV disease, and I was totally struck by that unique situation. The company that was developing the drug was right there in Houston, Texas, very near my home. So, and they asked me if I would like to come and help them complete the development of the product. And I said, sure, why not? This looks very interesting. And I joined that company. As oftentimes happens with small biotech companies, they get bought by big biotech companies. And the company I was working for was no different. It was acquired by Genentech. And Genentech reviewed the molecule that I was working on and decided they didn't want to go into the HIV therapeutic area. And they asked me to stick around and help them out-license that product. So I did. I didn't have a job. I might as well. So I did. and outlicensed it to a company called TaiMed Biologics. And TaiMed Biologics was founded by a gentleman named David Ho, who was a big name in HIV circles. He was Time Magazine's Man of the Year back in 1996. He's also probably better known for being Magic Johnson's doctor for a time. but he asked me to be his chief medical officer of the new company he had founded. And I said, sure, why not? I love developing this product. And so we did. And in 2018, we were very fortunate to have our drug approved for treatment of multi-drug resistant HIV. It's now marketed as Trogarzo. And
how did that feel, Stanley? Because look, not many drugs make it to market. I mean, the percentage is unreal, isn't it? The failure rate in the industry. How did that feel to kind of have, you know, followed that path, you know, from one company to Genentech to then on to another, and then to, you know, finally have that success? What did
finally
that feel
cross,
like?
Finally cross the finish line. It was very gratifying. It was over a 10-year journey. For me, and it meant everything for us to be able to bring a new therapy to patients who had been struggling with their disease, who'd really run out of options. So and to offer something that like I was saying before, was incredibly well tolerated. That made it all worth it. Certainly made that journey worth it. So that was that was 2018. It was about that time I got a call from my previous CEO, and she asked me to come out to California because she'd started a new company, and she wanted me to be her chief medical officer. So I said, sure, I've crossed this milestone. Why don't I try another one? on to the next one. You mentioned that some folks feel like they stumbled into their destiny. I'm probably one of those folks because none of these steps were really planned ahead of time. But I came out to California. We were developing a drug for treatment of hospitalized influenza. So people who get the flu, but then they can't fight it off. So they end up in the hospital with pneumonia.
Right.
And we were doing great. We had breakthrough therapy designation for our drug, and we were in phase 3 and started enrolling the trial. When COVID hit, and as I like to say, COVID cured the flu because no one was getting the flu anymore. We couldn't enroll this trial to save our lives. Even if you did get the flu, you wouldn't dare go to the hospital for fear you'd get COVID. So there was that. In addition to...
It was a strange time, wasn't it? And as you said, COVID, I mean, it was a terrible thing and killed millions of people, but it did... It cured a lot.
It wiped out the flu. Yeah, nobody was getting the flu at that time. We had a lot of other problems to deal with, and I, in addition to running those global clinical trials, which were great, but it was just sort of a dead time.
Yeah.
I was also in charge of finding additional assets for our company because our company only had the single asset, and we were looking for more things to put in our pipeline.
Yeah,
and so I did a lot of searching. I looked high and low, probably evaluated over 100 companies and products for potential in licensing. And I found one that I really liked. It was interesting to me because it looked like an antibiotic, but it was retooled to treat cancer. And so I thought, this is absolutely fascinating. Well, I couldn't convince the folks at my former company to in-license this product. So ultimately, I left and said, hey, I'll in-license it. And I formed A28 Therapeutics. We actually did an asset purchase, not only bought the lead compound that I was so excited about, but we also acquired the remaining pipeline of our predecessor company. And we were off to the races with A28 Therapeutics. And that's how I'm here.
So how does it, I mean, that's an incredible journey, even to just get to that point. And we've not even got into kind of what you're doing now, other than kind of the snapshot you gave at the top of the show. How does that work, Stanley, in terms of like you say in licensing that particular product and for someone, again, who doesn't get involved on the day-to-day research and the drug side of things and reviewing these products, What goes into that as kind of a chief medical officer? How does that even happen? What's the process for that?
Well, it's called diligence, and we basically reviewed all the data that had been accumulated for this particular product over the course of the last roughly a decade. And it turns out that the molecule that was so intriguing to me had already gone through a phase one clinical trial where it demonstrated safety. It had also gone through a phase two clinical trial where unfortunately it stumbled and didn't meet its primary endpoint. But in reviewing the data, we were able to identify a group of patients who really did well with this product. And they were clearly defined by the fact that they were late-stage patients who had developed liver metastases. That is, that their cancer, which was ovarian in origin, had metastasized to the liver. And for those patients, this drug worked really, really well. In fact, if you look back, and hindsight's 2020, if you look back, it all made sense. The drug, which is a lytic peptide, accumulates in the liver and persists there for 3 days. It doesn't hang around in the serum, sort of systemically very long, but in the liver, it persists for quite a long time. So where you get the most exposure, you get the most efficacy. So we saw a 69% ORR, that's overall response rate, in patients who had ovarian cancer with liver metastases who were treated with our drug, AT101, plus the standard of care, paclitaxel, versus a 17% ORR in patients who were treated with just the paclitaxel alone. So for these reasons, we felt like, wow, we've got a really cool drug with a unique ability to treat those patients who really need it the most. And if I might add one other thing, this drug was very consistent with my desire to only bring forth medications that are extremely safe and well tolerated. Unlike most chemotherapies that may cause hair loss or may cause nausea and vomiting and diarrhea and all sorts of neutropenias and anemias, et cetera, and make patients feel really terrible. This drug only had one really noteworthy side effect, and that is it caused a transient rash. This rash would usually occur around the site of the infusion. It lasted during the course of the infusion and usually resolved on its own before the patient even leaves the infusion center. But you can treat it with Benadryl or one other, another antihistamine to prevent it or even to treat it. Or you can just slow down the infusion rate and the patients don't get the rash at all. Now, this may sound a little bit familiar to some who heard this story before, in that this molecule is a lytic peptide, just like vancomycin, which is also a lytic peptide. And that's the exact same side effects you get with that antibiotic, and you can treat it the same way. So a very, very tolerable cancer drug that shows exactly which patients that are the best ones to be treated. Add to that, we've refined the patient selection assay so that we can identify almost to a, well, actually in our retrospective studies to 100% certain on the patients who will respond when we administer the drug. We feel extremely excited about going into our next clinical trial and demonstrating prospectively that we really know where this drug can be most useful.
Sounds incredible. I mean, it's just got me thinking. So, you didn't like the academic stuff that you were doing because the side effects, and that's not what you got into this business for. But then you found something that kind of mimicked the good side of what the drug that you then managed to bring to market identified this. I'm just curious as to why, because it almost sounds too good to be true, Stanley. I'm just wondering why your former employer kind of put the stop up on this. Like it, to me, it's kind of like, hold on, you've got someone who's been there and done it. They've got a success. They're telling you that they've found something that seems to fit the criteria where this can be done again, and that's not been taken on to the point where you've had to say, you know what, I believe in my own kind of theory on this so much that I'm going to go and do it myself. Well, it seems a little bit baffling. Were you surprised that your last employer didn't run with this? I'm guessing yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I couldn't understand why people couldn't see it the way I did. You know, there are a lot of sort of caveats to why you may select one product over another to go into your pipeline that you want to develop. I felt very strongly about this one. Others felt strongly about others that they would prefer to pursue. And this one just didn't make the cut. I will agree with you. It does in many ways sound almost too good to be true. And that bothered me a little bit as well. Obviously we're looking at retrospective data, you know, data that discovered or uncovered through a post hoc analysis of the data, but from that phase two clinical trial. But James, when you look at retrospective data, there's a couple things that you really want to be sure about, because retrospective data can be misleading. You want to make sure that the effect that you're seeing is incredibly consistent. You want to see, okay, every time I do this, every time I did this, every time I looked at this set of patients, I saw this response.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we saw. I think that was one of the reasons why it was very resonant to me. And the other thing is, you want it to make scientific sense. You want it to follow what you know to be true. And for our review of this product, it absolutely followed the drug's pharmacokinetics.
Mm-hmm.
The drug has got a 15-minute half-life in the serum, and it's got a 3-day biodistribution to the liver. So sure enough, when you looked at the liver, you saw that high exposure to the drug. You saw where you got your biggest bang for the buck, you know, the biggest response. So we felt like those two things, along with a few others, made us really feel confident that we were interpreting this post hoc analysis, this retrospective data, appropriately. And going into our next trial, we're going to make sure we do three things that really give us even more confidence that we will get a positive outcome. Number one, we're only going to look at patients who have liver metastases. That is a subset of patients who have the liver involved in their tumor. Number two, we're going to make sure that we select the patients who, by our new assay, have the LHRH receptor, and make sure that we don't enroll any patients who, for whatever reason, don't have that receptor.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, we're going to slightly increase the dose of the medication. We never found a maximum tolerated dose in the previous clinical trials. And the drug is so very well tolerated that we feel like a slight bump up in the dose may give us even better response rate than we saw in the previous trial. So we think we're on the right track, and we hope others will join us and support our company as we go back into the clinic. Fingers crossed, that'll be later this year.
Awesome stuff. Well, I mean, it sounds as though everything is going smoothly, it's going really well. You must be pleased with things. I guess, kind of taking you back to what I said before about that shock factor of your former company not taking it on, has presented this opportunity for you, which clearly you've run with and things are going well. Do you remember the point though, Stanley, where that there was that refusal or, you know, reluctance to take on the product and you decided, I'm going to do it myself? Because there may be other chief medical officers out there somewhere that are in the same situation, thinking, I'm a chief medical officer, this is my field, do I want to venture into now going from a CMO to a CEO and slightly changing things? Because it's a different world starting a business. Do you remember that moment where you're like, You know what? If you say no, I'm going to do it myself. Can you
Well,
remember it?
I do sort of remember thinking to myself, if I had hair, I'd be pulling it out right now. And the we had lots of back and forth amongst the management team and the leadership team of the farm company about which ones of these different candidates we had that we would go for. I think that this one just resonated with me. I don't think I found this drug. I sort of think it found me. I had this infectious diseases background working from an HIV perspective. And this drug looked like an infectious disease product, so it was very, very familiar to me. Others may not have been quite as familiar with this type of molecule, so they didn't have the comfort level that I did. So I certainly grant them the grace of not having that information, that insight, that I think was really helping to push me and helping me to see this molecule as entirely de-risked from a safety perspective and clear efficacy signal. Who wouldn't just go for it? I suppose that others may not have had that background, and therefore they didn't quite, they didn't quite have the comfort level. I would say that
Gotcha.
going from CMO to CEO, first of all, there's no blueprint. There's not a how to go from CMO to CEO.
I wish there was.
Well,
I mean,
maybe
when
I'll
I
write
started
it.
my business, I've still got the book on the shelf over here. It's kind of how to run a business for dummies. Like,
Yes.
I literally have that book.
Yeah, that's a good book. We need a version for making the transition from CMO to CEO. I think the one thing that has really helped me a lot is just staying true to this idea that I put the patients first. I want to do that which is going to help these patients, and I'm counting on building a team around me and make sure that all the other things are taken care of, because I feel obligated to set the vision of this company and to set the course and to set the culture by what is our true north, what guides us in what we're trying to do. And for me, that has been and always will be making sure that we develop the right products, the best products to help patients.
Definitely. Well, it's again just hearing you speak here, Stanley, and talking about kind of this drug finding you, it's almost like you can be in the right place at the right time, but you need to realize that you're in the right place at the right time. Your old company didn't necessarily realize that, but because of your background in the kind of infectious disease space, you did. And that's how this whole business and now mission has come about. So it's kind of an incredible journey. And the fact that you're talking about a world where people don't fear cancer and don't fear the treatment is incredible. So I mean, you've talked about kind of positive results, positive data from the trials that you've run to date, and perhaps being back in the lab later this year. How have things changed as an organization? I'd imagine that when you kind of decided to run with this, it was maybe yourself and I don't know, several others. But how have things changed in terms of the setup? Like the, are you office based? Is there a core team? What do things look like in terms of that?
Well, one of the challenges that we have right now, probably facing a lot of small biotech companies, is funding, right? We're in the process of raising our Series A, which we're raising a $25 million Series A round of funding. We're going to look at our molecule both to validate the signal that we saw in patients who had ovarian cancer with liver metastases. But interestingly enough, that receptor that I talked about that you find on these cancer cells is found on a lot of different tissue types, including hepatocellular carcinoma or liver cancer, bile duct cancer, uveal melanoma, several other different kinds of cancer, including lung and breast and colorectal and others that that are kind of the biggies. So we want to make sure that we don't just limit ourselves to treating a small a handful of patients with one indication, We want to be able to show that this product actually has the potential to be tumor tissue agnostic, and that that requires money, right? So we're gonna try to raise this round of financing so that we can get back into the clinic later this year.
Yeah.
And of course, in addition to raising the money, you've got to surround yourself with the right people. I'm very fortunate to have a co-founder of my company who had a business background and a legal background, which helped me with the intellectual property and helped me with sort of setting up the business. So we make a very good team. We've since recruited several advisors and some consultants that can help us with a lot of the sort of the day to day, roll up your sleeves, blocking and tackling of the business. And for us, it's better to sort of stay virtual because we don't spend a lot of time and or resources trying to locate, or relocate patients to one central location. We don't pay rent on brick and mortar offices and the like. And we are able to sort of streamline our expenses because of these, because we've made these corporate decisions in terms of prioritizing, sort of how we go forward. When I look at the whole sort of landscape in front of us, I think that more than anything, finding investors who can recognize this vision, who can relate to it, who have the resources that can put behind it and bring additional resources to the bear is really the challenge. And sometimes it's a numbers game. You've got to get out there and meet a bunch of folks and tell your story until it resonates with someone. So that's where we are right now, and we're going to keep at it until we kiss our prince, right?
Sure. Tell me about that, because I mean that's one of the big things when I speak to any CEOs is the fundraising element, getting the investors. I'm sat here thinking, the whole world would love to cure cancer. It seems that you are already doing it, and it's the sexy therapeutic area of the moment, that and perhaps gene therapy. Surely there's people queuing up for this, because when I spoke to my partner the other day after meeting you, I was like, I think I've just spoken to the man who's cured cancer, or he's actually curing it now. Like, I was just like amazed that this has happened. So why it seems so simple. Why isn't more therapeutics like this and more drugs out there that are curing cancer? Like now, the way you talk about it, Stan, it seems too easy.
Yeah, that does seem pretty easy. I have to admit that may be actually part of the problem. We in science, particularly in life sciences, tend to worship that which is more complex. So that which is simple oftentimes gets overlooked, not because it's not effective, not because it's not safe, but simply because it can't be that easy, right? And perhaps maybe it is. I'm sort of out to prove that. I have to be careful and caution with regards to the word cure. I think that's a scary word. We don't use it very often, and I too am a little bit apprehensive about using it as it relates to cancer, for sure. But I do believe this. I do believe that what we're doing may give us the blueprint for how to cure cancer. I think that what we're doing is akin to what we did in HIV disease, quite frankly, is we ultimately found therapies that were safe, that didn't have overlapping toxicities, that we could combine and put in one regimen to put the pathogen, in that case HIV, in a bind to where it couldn't replicate and it couldn't go on to kill the immune system and ultimately kill the patient. I think that we're trying to do the exact same thing in cancer. I see a lot of similarities between cancer and infectious diseases. They both represent a defeat of our immune system. In infectious diseases, it's a bacteria or a virus or a fungus or whatever that defeats your immune system and runs amok. And in cancer, it's one of your own human cells that mutates and then runs amok, right? So what we need is the immune system to be engaged in a way that allows the pathogen or the pathology, in this case cancer, to be controlled and preferably to be eliminated. And what we need regimens of medications that can force the tumor to sort of stop growing, lyse it, kill it, whatever, and then in the same time, recruit the immune system to keep that tumor under control and hopefully to eliminate it. So what I think we're doing here at A28 with our lead molecule AT101 and our entire pipeline of molecules behind it and our platform for building even more molecules like it is that we are offering a therapy that doesn't have competing, or should I say overlapping toxicities with other medications that may be in the regimen, where it's very safe and effective. At least it has great anti-tumor activity and it's very well tolerated thus far. Careful not to say safe and effective until it's approved. And I think that the wonderful thing, and I hadn't even really mentioned this up until this point, is that it synergizes with all of those other medications that we've talked about before, whether it's chemotherapeutic agents or the newer therapies like immune oncology agents. And in that process, it recruits the immune system to help to control and hopefully eliminate the cancers. To me, it's a drug that deserves a chance. It's a platform that deserves a chance to show that it can work. And hopefully, knock on wood, we'll get some investors who agree with us and we'll get it back into the clinic really soon.
Definitely. I mean, I certainly hope you do, and like we'll be staying in contact to hear that. And I almost can't wait to get this episode out on the air, because I think as you and I have discussed, there's very few people, if anyone, that we all know who haven't been affected by cancer in the family or by people they know in some way, shape, or form. So to hear this, like I did the other day, it's going to give so many people hope to know that actually there are, treatments that, work in this way, and that the treatment isn't, near as bad as the disease itself. So, Stan, it's incredible, and I certainly think that A28 is going to be a big name in the future. But talking about the name, I always ask people, where did the name come from?
Oh,
How
well,
did you put this together?
that's a very interesting story. We had a long list of potential names for our company. Most of them, inspirational or aspirational names that we were going to use. They were all taken. They either had trademarks or they had the URL was purchased.
Damn
And so
it.
we were frustrated. And then we came up with something really simple. Our molecule has 28 amino acids. So there's a 10 amino acid hormone. It's bound to an 18 amino acid lytic peptide, 10 plus 18, 28, A28. A couple of things about that.
Simplicity again, though, Stanley. The
It's
simplicity,
simple.
there's a
You
running
got to
theme
give
here.
it. You got to give it to us. It is pretty simple, and there are some benefits of if your company name starts with an A and you've got 20, you got a number after it, you'll be at the top of every alphabetical list. So there's a good thing about it. I told you I'm from Texas, right? So some people think I talk with an accent. I don't think I have much of a Texas accent. But when I say A28, some folks hear 8:28. So when they hear 8:28, they think, "Oh, you named it after Romans 8:28, which is a Bible verse that says, all things work together for good." And I was like, "Dog, I wish I had named it 8:28. That's a pretty good name." But alas, it is much more simple and much more concrete. That it's just named after our lead molecule, A28.
Awesome stuff. Well, at least it's got a bit of a story behind it now as well, hey? You can't
Yeah.
knock that.
You can't beat that, right?
Perfect stuff. Well, look, Stanley, it's been a pleasure kind of hearing this, and as I say, inspirational stuff. When I stumbled across your profile and then jumped on a call with you, I just could not believe that this is the work that you're doing. And it's amazing. That's why I can't wait to get this show out. I guess through this process of building the business and taking trials through and kind of FDA approvals previously, what would you have? I get the sense that probably not too much has changed because it sounds like you've been very true to your own values from day one about doing it for the patients. But is there anything that you've learned about yourself or, that you have developed as a person since kind of going through all of these stages?
Wow, that's a great question. I would say the thing I've learned most about myself is that that I can be very resilient. That this is a marathon. It's not a sprint, and you have to be very very conscious of the fact that most projects actually don't work. I've been one of the fortunate folks where most of the things I've worked on have come to fruition, but they take a long time. They require diligence. They require thoughtfulness. They require a team. They require, you can't do it by yourself. You've got to have folks who are good at what they do and willing to give their time and their talents to the same goal and objectives that you have. And for me, I would say that being resilient has been the one thing that I've learned about myself that I didn't realize I had before I started, but it has come into it's really come in handy as we've gone. And James, I wouldn't say I've never been more hopeful than I am right now about this company and about the future of cancer care. If we can bring molecules like this that have these same characteristics to the fore, I am still a believer that we can cure this disease. It is not beyond us. And I'm going to do everything I can, do my part, to make that happen.
Wow. Well, I think myself and everyone listening will be rooting for you on that front. And that's clearly the plan. So you're saying that, not only once, you're back in the lab and you've hopefully done this for the ovarian side of things that you're looking at the moment, you're then going to focus on different types and re-engineer. I don't know if that's the right term, so correct me if I'm wrong, but re-engineer kind of the molecule to treat other forms of cancer as well.
That is correct. Re-engineer is not too far off, right? So our molecule has two parts. One is the payload, the lytic peptide, that will remain the same. But we can take off the LHRH receptor targeting unit and put on different types of receptors. So we can put on other hormone receptors like LH or FSH. We can put on other molecules that can bind to HER2 or VEGF or CD20 or CD19 or you name it, some other different kinds of receptors that are found on different types of tumors, so that we can kill those tumors using our same payload, the same mechanism of cytotoxicity, but we just target it to a different kind of tumor. So this is a gift that if we can prove the concept, it can keep giving to lots of different tumor types, and hopefully help lots and lots of patients.
Amazing stuff. And look, I mean, hopefully at some point down the line, I'm saying I once interviewed the man that cured cancer. But what will it mean to you to kind of have followed this journey as you have to then, kind of get success number one and then hopefully get success number two, three, four, five, whatever it may be? I mean, you've already had an FDA approval, which most people will be on the top of the world about. How, what would, I just can't even imagine how that's going to feel. I mean, do you vision, do you that vision, what do you think that's going to feel like?
Wow. I haven't really given it that much thought. I think for me, it's really about purpose. I think I have stumbled To use your word from earlier, I have stumbled upon my purpose, and that is to develop new types of therapies for treating very bad diseases. That's sort of why I think I'm on the planet. I'm a dyslexic. I have that learning sort of disability or difference,
wow.
I suppose. But it has turned out to be a superpower because it allows me to see things differently than other folks do. And sometimes I had one of my former bosses say, this guy doesn't think inside the box. He doesn't even know where the box is. And that has turned out to be the best part of being in drug development, because it allows me to be very creative. Sure, I've got all the doctor, physician training that gives you a nice foundation of sort of the lay of the land. But from there, the world is wide open to possibilities.
Dyslexia, the new superpower for
it's the
CMOs.
New superpower. Yeah, you got to go get some. It's
exactly. Wow.
It does allow you to be unconfined in the way you think. And so I tend not to follow the herd. I tend not to follow the crowd.
Clearly.
I tend to go
yeah.
off and explore in other different directions. And I believe that at the end of the day, that's how breakthroughs happen, right? They're incremental improvements, and that's great. But for me, I prefer breakthroughs. I prefer breaking new ground, innovation. And so dyslexia comes in great for that. It comes in really handy.
Stanley, there is honestly so much about you. It's unreal. I could probably sit here and quiz you for days on end. But look, we'll have to bring things to a close, certainly for today at least. I'm going to have to get you back at some point. But look, we always do close the show with a quick fire questions round to get a few more snippets of wisdom from our guests. So I'll hit you with some of these. The first one is, what is one piece of advice that you perhaps give or tell your younger self, Stanley?
Oh, my younger self, I would say, don't give up. Don't stop. It's, you're going to meet, you're going to come into obstacles, and you're going to have, things that you need to overcome, and there are going to be speed bumps, and there may be people or other things that stand in your way, but just keep going, find a way around them, and get to your goal.
Nice. Resiliency, I guess.
Resiliency again.
Amazing. And look, I can see a few books on the shelf behind you there, but what is the number one book or resource, podcast, movie? It could be anything that you would recommend for our audience.
Wow. There's a few really good titles up there. The one that I read most recently that I think was as sort of ringing around in my head was Founder's Dilemma.
Right.
Sort of wish I had read it before I founded the company. But suffice to say, there's quite a bit of wisdom in that book. I really loved one of the classics, Good to Great, the Collins book.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading some Mark Cuban recently, actually. A book that, I don't think he wrote it, but I think it's all of his some interviews that he's done. Maybe actually a podcast he's done. And so I really like what he's doing with drug pricing. And I think that's something else I want to make sure that if we develop, I should say when we develop AT101, that we make sure that it's accessible to other patients. To all patients. We've already done all of our forecasting and peak sales estimates by basing this drug half of the cost of the average oncology drug over the last 5 years.
Wow.
And it's still a billion-dollar opportunity. So we're super excited about making sure that not only do we bring a drug that's safe, that's effective, but also doesn't break the bank so patients can afford it. And that's another book I've been sort of thumbing through recently and take and drawing some wisdom.
Awesome stuff. That sounds amazing. And look, you've kind of already hinted at it and talked to me about having quite a lean operation for the amount of work that you're doing as a team. But what are the top three qualities that you perhaps value most when putting together your team or just working in a team?
Oh, wow. Well, the most important thing to me is honesty. You know, the person who works with me has to be honest. They have to have integrity. What we're doing is just too important to be fudging, or to say something you know that you don't know. I'd rather you just tell me you don't know, and that would be just fine, because none of us know everything. We'll find someone who knows. So being honest is very, very important. I would say that you have to have fun. I really like to smile and laugh. And you know, you spend way too much of your time at work. So you really should make sure that what you're doing is what you really want to do, and that you have fun doing it. And if you're not having fun, you're probably doing the wrong thing. And then, you know, I think, you know, you have to be motivated. You have to get up and be hardworking and go to, you know, and do the things that are required of you. You can't let the team down. You have to be a team player. So you got to show up, and you got to get, you know, you've got to be about doing the work. I think those three things. Because you could ask me tomorrow, I might come up with three or four more things, because there are a lot of qualities that really matter.
At least
matter.
You're honest.
But those are the three that popped into my head today. And I don't think the honesty thing will ever change. It'll always probably be at the top. But certainly being motivated and having fun are also very important.
Awesome stuff. Now, I guess on the subject of having fun is fun to everyone, I guess. But what do you do outside of work? Again, we all spend far too much time sometimes at work. What do you do to relax? You know, who is the social man behind this kind of incredible idea generation, man, that you seem to be, Stanley?
I'm just so fortunate to have a wonderful family. My wife and my two kids, they keep me going. All the time outside of my office is spent either at a soccer game or a track meet, or you know, taking my son to the movies because he's totally into the Marvel comic series.
Nice.
And then if I can, if we're very fortunate enough and we can get my mother-in-law to watch the kids, my wife and I go out to a nice dinner. It's heaven. I really can't complain. I don't have any particular hobbies because I actually love what I do. So it's not like I need to go away to feel, you know, happy or fulfilled. What I do for a living is absolutely, I mean, it's I get excited about it every day. But whenever I do walk outside that office, I have another wonderful option. That is my family. I can't do any of this without them.
Amazing. I mean, you've pretty much summed up my last question that I normally ask people, which is about, you know, kind of your advice, your number one golden rule for life and business. But I think you've literally just nailed that with your last answer.
Yeah, it's a balance, right? It's being able to make sure that that what you're doing is, you know, is resonant to you. It sort of amplifies, you know, your aliveness. It matches with your core values, and then, you know, pursuing that with all that's, you know, sort of all that's in you. And for me, I'm motivated by that, which helps others. You know, some folks may be motivated by the money, and certainly the money's nice. Others may find other things that sort of get them going. The thing that fuels me is being able to deliver a drug to patients that really needs it, that didn't have any other option. That's what I wake up for.
Amazing stuff. Look, Stanley, it really has been incredible having you on the show. For anyone that wants to reach out to learn more or offer investment, having heard this story, what's the best way to get hold of you other than looking on an A to Z list and finding you at the top?
Yes. Well, I think there's a couple of ways. First, you can go to our website. In fact, I would encourage all your listeners and viewers to visit us at a28therapeutics.com. And I personally can be reached at my email address, which is Stanley, Stanley dot Lewis, Lewis, at a28therapeutics.com.
Awesome stuff. Stanley, as I say, look, had such a good time having you on the show. We will certainly keep in contact, but thanks again for jumping on the Huxley Morton podcast.
Thank you very much, James. This has been my pleasure.